This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has an obesity problem. In fact, it has been described as an epidemic. Obesity, of course, leads to a slew of other conditions that negatively impact health, like an increased incidence of diabetes and heart disease, and many of these diseases, which used to present late in life, are now showing up in children. As scientists and medical experts have been searching for reasons to explain this change in American life, they've focused on laying the blame solely on our diets. But our guest today has been looking in a different direction. Dr. Richard J. Jackson is a professor and chair of the Environmental Health Sciences at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. But earlier in his career, he was the highest-ranking health and environmental official in the country, spending 9 years at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. He believes that many of the health problems that appear to be increasing, like obesity and even asthma, are the result of how America has been built since World War II. We're going to spend the hour investigating that claim and hearing some of his solutions to correct the problem. Welcome to town. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mike.
Nice to have you here. As I mentioned, you were the director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health in California. You helped establish a birth defects monitoring program. You've helped pass state and national laws governing the use of pesticides. At the CDC, you'd established a national asthma epidemiology and control program. So you've been working on these problems and looking into these problems for a long time. Did you reach your conclusions about the built environment being a culprit in all of this because of that work, or did your conclusions about how of the impact about how we build move you toward that work?
You know, Mike, I'm a health and environment official, but I'm a pediatrician by training. Wow. And I did about 15 years of environmental health in California when I was offered the position at CDC in 1994. That job was enormous. We had everything from atoms of lead that caused brain damage and hazards to children. We had a $50 million childhood lead program. We looked at molecules, chemicals in the environment that cause people's harm, whether they're feminizing chemicals or other sorts of things. We looked at bigger things like the oversight of the destruction of the chemical weapons of the United States, and even the largest thing, which is climate change and the change in the environment of our planet. And one day in 1999, I was driving down Buford Highway in Atlanta, Georgia, to the CDC headquarters. And probably some of your listeners have been on that road or a similar road. 7 lanes wide, about a mile and a half between crosswalks lined with garden apartments and homes of the poor on both sides. And it was a hot day. It was in the high 90s, and I was rushing. And I looked over to the side of the road, and I saw an elderly woman walking along, and she was bent over with osteoporosis, carrying shopping bags. It was hot. The air quality was terrible. And she was struggling, and I wanted to stop and give her a ride, and I didn't do it. I went to my meeting, and at the meeting, we're talking about all these big threats, the obesity epidemic, the inactivity epidemic, on and on and on, large threats to America's health. And I began to think, you know, if that poor woman collapses and dies, the cause of death will be heat stroke, and it won't be bad air quality, absence of trees, lack of public transportation. And if she's killed by a truck going by, the cause of death will be motor vehicle trauma, and it won't be absence of sidewalks and public transportation. And so the bottom line is the way we've built, in some way, the upstream causes of these problems are how we have built America. Mm-hmm. And we knew how to build great towns in America before World War II.
Hmm. I feel that we're going to talk about new urbanism as we go through this program today. You've written 2 books about this, Urban Sprawl and Public Health, which you wrote in 2004, and Making Healthy Places in 2011. You're working on a new book now. You've done a PBS series on healthy communities. I think it's a 4-episode series, is that right? And obviously you have a lot to say about the topic, which we'll not be able to cover in the time we have allotted here. But in a nutshell, how does the way we build connect to health? Is it simply that we built environments that are not friendly to exercise?
You know, we've built places that really require us to be isolated. Average American can't buy a carton of milk or a newspaper without getting in a car. About 6 pounds of the 20 pounds that we've gained over the last 2 decades come from removing physical activity from our lives. So what we eat still matters a lot. But as we've built it and require people to spend more and more time, I am now in Los Angeles where virtually no one can afford to live near the University of California, Los Angeles. All of our young professors are commuting in an hour and a half each way. And every meeting starts with the statement, I'm sorry I was late. There was a traffic wreck on such and such a highway to get there. And if you ask the average person in many of our cities in the United States, what's the hardest part of your day? They don't say to you, my job. They say, my commute is the hardest thing in my life. And the more we put people in cars and the more we separate them from the things that they love, the people they love, the harder we're making people's lives.
You mentioned a pound, six pounds. We've gained 6 pounds of the 20 pounds that we've gained in the last whatever it was, 20 years that you said. It's because of our lack of access to walking, our need to use the car. And a study of residents here in Charlotte, which I was going to ask you about, so I'll ask you about it now. These people who started using the Lynx Blue Line light rail system here in Charlotte, which opened a couple of years ago, over the course of 1 to 2 years, people taking that train lost an average of 6.5 pounds and reduced their risk of obesity by 81%. I was going to ask if you thought that was correct, and I guess it is.
It is absolutely correct. And, you know, how many people that were behind putting that light rail system in place, I'm sure they put it there so people could get to work on time, be able to read a book, be less stressed. But it turns out this incidental physical activity, when we call it active transportation, yeah, you can walk, you can bike, or you can take light rail, is useful exercise just like anything you'd do at the gym.
Except for the fact, once you get on the train, it's like being in the car. You're sitting or standing, but you're not walking anymore. Maybe you have to walk a couple of blocks from your apartment or condominium and then a couple of blocks to your office. But does that really make that much of a difference, really?
It does. I mean, one flight of stairs a day, just a little bit of exercise going up one flight of stairs, if you do that for a year, that's a pound of body fat burned off. So it doesn't take a lot of exercise to burn it off. And if you just add 100 calories to everybody's diet for a couple of years, you've added pounds of body fat. So it's not that hard to begin to burn it off more. And the light rail, it's funny, when people put it in place, I'm sure they never thought this was a physical activity and health program. They thought it was ways to save money.
But it also does lead to people living near the light rail. And what has happened here in Charlotte, and I'm sure it's happened in other places around the country in mid-sized cities that put in fixed mass transit, is that development crops up all along the line. And that kind of development that has cropped up here, at least, has been kind of live, work, play. Once you get off the train and go home from work, there are restaurants, there are gyms, there are little parks, there are places to go that you can walk to. You don't have to get into a car. And once you get off the train when you're going to work, you're probably not going to hop a bus. You're going to take the 3-block walk to work. So you are giving yourself opportunities.
It's all being built in. You know, it's funny, when I moved to Los Angeles to teach at UCLA, someone said, well, pick where you're going to live very carefully, because when you get there, you're not going to want to go anywhere else because it's just so hard to get anywhere. In LA, people typically do one thing in a day. And wow. I did a rotation in New York City. Honestly, one day I was able to go for a walk in Central Park, go to Yankee Stadium, watch a ball game, and go down and see a play in one 10-hour period. You can't do that in many American cities because you have to be in the car and the roads are stopped.
Wow. The increase in obesity and diabetes and other conditions seem recent to me. Don't recall hearing a lot about this or witnessing a lot of this until the 70s, mid-70s, late 70s, pretty much. A lot of health experts say that this is due to packaged, processed foods. Some more say that a lack of exercise by kids has led to this. Is that part of the problem, or are you laying most of the blame on the sprawling suburbs?
Every health problem we have has multiple causes. The average American consumption of high fructose corn sugar, for example, is in the range of 50 to 60 pounds a year. No one consumed high fructose corn sugar before 1968. We've added more and more foods that taste really good. They're loaded with sugar, fat, and salt. And we've done a good job at quantity in the American diet. We've not done a good job with quality. And I'd love to see the movement that's going on here in the Charlotte area where people are trying to eat much more locally produced mm-hmm. food and healthier food. And I think that's all moving in the right direction. But it's both. We've got to eat more sensibly. We also have to put physical activity back in our lives.
We also eat more in restaurants. And a lot of people who live in so-called food deserts, the only food available to them really is junk food and or fast food, which is, as we all know, loaded with fat and salt and sugar. And in the 1960s and 70s, when I was growing up, it was a treat to go to McDonald's. It was a treat. It was not an everyday experience. It was a reward. Is that a fundamental change as well?
You know, I have a friend who's a doctor in Richmond, California, a very poor city, and she said to me one day, Dick, I have seen six teenage girls with gallbladder surgery scars on them. And I said, what was going on? They had cholesterol gallstones. And she asked them, what do you eat? And there was no place to get fresh fruits and vegetables in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they're eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner in fast food places. By the way, fast food is not a great investment in terms of even what you get for that money. Every time you supersize a meal, you add an ounce of fat to your body. And an ounce of fat added to a man's body is about $6 of healthcare costs. To a woman, it's about $3.50 in healthcare costs. So over and over again, we make short-term decisions. The stuff tastes good and it's relatively cheap, but they're bad long-term decisions.
You wrote an article, I think it was in The Atlantic, where you pointed out that in 1960, fewer than 1 in 10 American children were overweight or obese. And today, that number is 1 in 4. So we've gone from 10% to 25%. That's an enormous number of kids.
Some states, we have one-third of the adults are obese and another third are overweight. So two-thirds of our population. See a movie from the early 1970s and you're shocked how skinny everyone looks
yes.
compared to today.
Yes. I'm shocked at how large everybody is today and how it happened so quickly, it seems.
But it's important not to blame the folks that are struggling with this, because I think in many ways the way we've set things up shape our people to be that way.
But I mean, if a lot of this is to be blamed on how we have built the built environment, how we have built these sprawling suburbs. I grew up in a suburb. I'm not overweight.
Did you walk or bike to school?
Yes, but mostly I took the bus. I wasn't allowed to bike to school until I was in high school, and then after I did it a couple of times, it very quickly became apparent that that wasn't cool.
Okay. But, you know, back in your era, two-thirds of kids walked or biked to school, and today it's 1 in 8.
And it was uphill in both directions.
Well, that's because it was snowing at the time.
That's right. So my question is, I grew up in a suburb, and yes, I biked all the time when I was a kid in the neighborhood with friends. We roller skated up and down the street all the time. We played sports on the street all the time. Is that the difference? Kids don't do that anymore?
It's very much so. In the video series, we interviewed six girls in Smyrna, Georgia, and they're in their 13, 14, 15-year-olds. What's your life like? And they said, well, it's boring. We have to ask our parents to drive us absolutely everywhere, to go to the mall, to go anywhere else. The Academy of Pediatrics has actually written a prescription, a policy statement saying kids need to grow up in neighborhoods where they have increasing autonomy, increasing ability to take on the world. And so we're looking at real changes.
I want to ask you about that, because some of it may be the built environment and some of it could be the culture of fear that has engulfed us in the last 30 or 40 years. Parents won't let the kids go out because they might be captured by a predator. We're coming right back with Dr. Richard Jackson, professor and chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Thanks for tuning in to this encore edition of Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Francis Dawson of Homes of LKN, serving buyers and sellers of residential real estate in the Lake Norman area for over 12 years. Details at homesoflkn.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, the conventions are still weeks away, but the general election air war has begun in North Carolina and in other battleground states. Hillary Clinton has poured 8 figures into TV commercials, while Donald Trump has yet to put a single general election ad on the air. These commercials, particularly attack ads, have been a hallmark of White House campaigns for decades. take a look at the history of campaign ads and how they've changed in the social media age when Charlotte talks with guest host Michael Bitzer tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Congress has only 8 more days in session before senators and representatives take their August recess. The political party conventions begin in mid-July. An update on what's happening in Congress and the presidential campaigns.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Jackson, who is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. He was formerly the director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health, the highest-ranking environmental official in the country. He has 2 books to his credit, at least about this topic, Urban Sprawl and Public Health, also Making Healthy Places, and his new book, which has not yet come out, is going to be about how to build America for healthier people, essentially. We've been talking about how the built environment contributes to this rise in obesity, along with diet and lack of exercise. But a lot of kids who live in suburban neighborhoods, which when you drive through them, they look perfectly safe. I never see kids on the street anymore. Never. Never. You had to slow down in my neighborhood because kids were playing in the middle of the street. It was a suburban neighborhood. There was no through traffic. But kids don't do that anymore. And some of that, and I've talked to kids about this, and I've talked to parents about this, some of it is they can't leave the backyard or they can't leave the front yard. And we really don't want them in the front yard because there's a street at the front yard. We'd rather have them in the backyard. How much of it is the culture of unnecessary fear that we have about what might happen if they escape the envelope of the house?
You know, Mike, I'm a physician. I've seen lots of blood. And when I watch television, I can barely stand it because there's pain or horror or blood
around every corner.
So many shows that one's watching. And
every show on CBS primetime is about murder.
We're primed to be frightened of the world that we're in. And so Americans feel safest if they're in a great big car driving into a great big house that's got a automatic garage door opener, doesn't have to deal with anyone. And to bring our children up in such an isolated, overprotected environment doesn't prepare them for the very difficult world we're facing. And so, you know, the absolute risk of a child being abducted by a stranger today is no different than it was when you were a child.
And crime has gone down since I was a child.
Murder rates in some of our big cities have gone down 7-fold. Mm-hmm. So, but the awareness that the world is a menacing place has gone up dramatically, and partly it's being exploited by the media. I think one thing, you know, nobody's going to want their 8-year-old daughter walking all by herself to a mile to school if no other child is out there. And so in my hometown, I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, my sister leads a walking school bus where she collects a bunch of the kids, rain or shine, and they walk in a group of 8 to 10. And the kids actually like it. Kids who walk and bike to school socialize better, learn better, behave better. The teachers can tell the difference from the kids who sit in a car all day long.
And we've talked about this on this program, but we've done a series of shows on helicopter parents. And I remember as a kid in the summer when we had nothing to do because there was no school to go to and we couldn't afford to go to summer camp, my mother would say, okay, 9 o'clock, get out of the house. You know what time lunch is. You know what time dinner is. Be back for it. That was it. We went up into the woods, we played, we went on the street, we played, went to other people's houses, we played. We came home at lunchtime, we came home at dinner time. There were no phone calls back and forth, there were no cell phones, no texting to say, Mom, I'm at John's house. We just did it.
Richard Louvre has written a wonderful book called Last Child in the Woods where he talks
about this. He's
been on
this program.
And Richard talked about he was living in a subdivision that had some very nice forested name, and there was a creek through the forest, and the kids went out and built a dam with rocks in the creek. And the next thing you know, there was a notice sent out, the kids aren't to play in the creek and aren't to build rocks. And there are schools that are cutting the limbs off, lower limbs off trees, so kids can't climb trees.
If we were to go back to that behavior, if we let kids be kids, would the obesity problem be impacted at all?
A little bit. I mean, you can't...
Everything adds up, though.
You can't eat like a Amish farmer who was burning 7,000 calories a day doing very hard work. We have got, you know, if we keep it down to a couple thousand calories, yeah, we'd probably lose weight if we re-inoculated our lives with a lot more physical activity.
You talked about Los Angeles, which is where you live now because you're at UCLA, and Los Angeles is the home of movie stars, all these beautiful people walking around. And when you think of California, when you think of California in general, particularly L.A., you think of beautiful people, not just movie stars, but the people on Muscle Beach. You think about people biking and going to the gym all the time because they're in California and it's a healthy environment. Is L.A. healthy or is it unhealthy by and large because of the traffic and the lack of – you cannot walk in Los Angeles. You can't.
You know, I lived in L.A. for 7 years without a car. I used the bus
really?
Or bicycle okay. almost absolutely everywhere. UCLA is relatively close to the ocean, but the – physicians who are most, a lot of them live in Santa Monica. It's 7 miles from the hospital. It will take them an hour to an hour and a half to get to work. And so one of the things we're agitating for is to have a bike route between the hospitals and connecting up to the light rail. We added a half cent to the sales tax 3 years ago to build $30 billion worth of light rail and other kinds of rail and transit in L.A.
We've added
another sales tax just in the last couple of weeks.
Was there pushback on adding that sales tax for that purpose?
To be honest, there's been a lot of support, and it's come everything from the Chamber of Commerce. You know, they want people to come to work on time, all the way to the unions that want to have the work in the building going on. Everybody in L.A. is at their wits' end with the traffic. You know, 50 years ago, you could get downtown from the other side in way less than an hour on the light rail. Back in the – actually in the 50s and 60s, they tore out the rail, dumped the trolley cars into the Pacific, and now you can be in the fastest Maserati in the world, and you will get downtown even slower than people could 60 years ago. So it's the one topic we all know. It's actually deterring people from wanting to move there. And by the way, those beautiful people that you talk about, that's 3, 4, 5% of the population. It's very much built on the back of the poor.
Right.
And the poor live in places with no parks and very little transportation. And a lot of the poor are actually bicycling to work on the high-speed, dangerous streets. So there's a lot of changes we need to make, and they're being made.
Now, there are obviously a lot of negatives about living in the suburbs in that if you want to go buy a gallon of milk, you have to get in the car to do it because walking would simply be impractical. Either there'd be no sidewalk or it'd be too far away to go to the grocery store and lug a bunch of groceries back, unless you're like that elderly woman you saw in Atlanta. But surely there are positive forces about living in the suburbs that either balance that out or come close to balancing that out, aren't there?
You know, we knew how to build great suburbs in 1900 to about 1940. There were generally trolley car suburbs, and I think a lot of around Charlotte was built in the same way.
Yeah, Dilworth, so, Elizabeth.
Right, and the trolley line stopped, and there was local shops and maybe even a civic center and a town square, and then you went to the next stop and to the next stop, and you knew your neighbors, and people could walk. And so there are places being developed, and I know some of these because my colleagues are doing studies. They're actually measuring how active people are by watching how their smartphones move in a geographic area and also looking at kids' activity. And if you build a place that really is well-designed to connect people together, we can show big increases, almost a doubling in how much people walk and how active they are. The studies to show that they're less depressed, we don't have those yet. And by the way, the second most common disorder in America is depression after dental caries, cavities.
Really?
The treatment for mild to moderate depression
is exercise.
Is exercise and being with people you love and who care about you. And it's festivals and celebrations because we all have to struggle with hard things in our lives.
Right.
Anything we do that makes people more and more isolated is bad for them.
And there's an article, and this is kind of a sidebar, but there's an article in the paper this morning that Facebook – people who get on Facebook and they read about the good things that are happening in other people's lives become depressed because it's not happening in their life. And it seems to me that this whole social media thing is isolating.
Oh, you know, we all know the picture of the four high school kids sitting at the table in the diner and they're all not talking and
right.
texting at the same
right.
time. You know, I don't know how to fix this one. I mean, I putting electronics, you know, not being connected to other people's bad for us.
Yeah. In your PBS series, it's called Designing Healthy Communities, you looked at poor urban design and you looked at quality design, if I understand, because I'm not seeing the series, but that's what I read about it. Give me some examples of both.
You know, the healthiest city in the healthiest state in the United States won't surprise you. It's Boulder, Colorado. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, it's got good income, a university, lots of young people, but that's age-adjusted, that healthiest stuff. But 80 years ago, Olmsted himself, his sons, designed the walkways and bikeways along the rivers that came out of the Flatiron Mountains. And, so, and you pretty much can go anywhere and do anything you want on a bicycle. And they added more and more roads over time. The negative about there is, by the way, that now middle-class people can barely afford to live there. And so places that are really walkable and people don't have to be owned by their cars are selling at a premium. And in fact, all through the recession, the places that were walkable held their value far better mm-hmm. than those that didn't. So what we're seeing, I'm jumping around on you a little bit here, but what we're seeing is a lot of our young people, the age that people go and get driver's licenses today compared to 20 years ago is much older. Our smart young people can't – they don't want to get in cars and lead the rat race lives that their parents led. They want to be in places where they can meet their yeah. life needs. Probably the two most difficult cities that I visited, I had two camera crews for 3 days, each in Detroit and in Atlanta. Atlanta, I started out – it was called Sprawlanta from worst to first. And I lived in Atlanta for 10 years. I found it extraordinarily difficult. Every day I saw a car wreck on my way to work. It has a much higher rate of both pedestrian and car deaths than per capita than other cities in the country. I'll tell you a quick story maybe later, but about when CDC put out the guidelines for physical activity for the United States of America in the late 90s. And I ranted and raved at the meeting saying we have no right to tell people how to live and why they should be active because there isn't a sidewalk within 2 miles of CDC. Mm. And, it really was the beginning of this argument that we need to create places that are healthier.
Well, you write and talk about people-centered planning. So your argument is that we have been designing for 50 years for the automobile, not for people. How did that happen?
No, there's about five reasons, one of which is traffic codes and roadway codes were built for the automobile and to maximize speed and turning radius and other sorts of things. Two is housing codes were put in place to separate where people live from where they work from where they played. Atlanta, half the parks in Atlanta you can't get into unless you're in a car. So we've become so automobile-focused, we're not meeting those needs. So there are codes that have done it. And then there's actually loan or mortgage programs that really incentivize building sprawl. And it's easy to get money to just build houses, cookie cutter, on a beautiful old green field. It's much harder to get the funding to build on the parking lot across the street, which is valuable land and ought to have a 10 or 15-story building, maybe with some residential and everything else.
But also, so many people don't want to live in that. They want to live in the white picket fence with the yard and the single-family home, and they don't want to live in a box in a building in the sky. How do you fight that?
57% of the people looking for a place to live want to live in a walkable community. Mm-hmm. 43% want to be in the typical suburban measure.
Well, as you say, we used to build neighborhoods like that. Dilworth was a streetcar neighborhood in Charlotte. It had a streetcar that ran from downtown up into the neighborhood. It is now a close-in neighborhood, but it used to be the farthest out you could go before you hit the farmland. Why did we stop doing that? I remember I grew up in Washington, D.C. I watched them tear out the streetcar system. They tore it out. Then 20 years later, they put in a subway system, which is essentially the same thing. But why did we gravitate toward that? Why did we do things that people obviously enjoyed living in and do it differently?
This is going to sound – part of it was World War II. The United States came back from World War II. We had 19 million GIs that were getting out of uniform. We needed to keep them busy. We needed to keep the economy going because there's always big depressions after wars. And so we incentivized it by, sprawl consumes huge amounts of land and materials.
Yes, but when Levittown is a
classic example.
The classic example. And that's a post-World War II neighborhood to take care of these returning GIs who were coming back and starting families, and they built these cookie-cutter houses in this enormous tract of land. But why couldn't they, if you really want to keep the economy going, why wouldn't they, why didn't they invest in light rail or some kind of a transportation system that led into the city that Levittown was near, because that it's enormously expensive to build those systems. That elevates the economy.
The cars and the needs of automobiles were 25% of the GDP during the 20th century of the United States. So 25% of all the money went to cars, gas, roadways, steel, you name it, concrete that built all of this. And there were a lot of economic reasons why people wanted to do it. We built high-speed roads, by the way, with an intention of connecting cities together, and then we rather foolishly ran the roads right through the hearts of cities. And we visited Syracuse, where it was a great city that was basically quadrisected, cut into four pieces by the high-speed roads, and two of the neighborhoods died because of it.
And I think the reason we have the interstate highway system in large part is because of the push that President Eisenhower put in to do just that. And I believe he opted to do it with highways rather than with trains because he saw what happened to the railways in Europe as the result of World War II.
He did, and the autobahns worked well.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying the highways were a bad idea, but once the highways were put in place, everybody realized that, you know, I could get 20 miles out of town in 20 minutes.
Right.
And that's when that sprawl land became very valuable.
So there are a bunch of ailments that have been connected, or you've connected, to the urban sprawl that we've experienced over the last 50 years or so, 60 years. Obesity, diabetes, asthma, allergies. Let's talk a little bit about this. Obesity we've talked about. That's pretty, you know, and diabetes is kind of an offshoot, a result of being overweight. What about asthma?
I want to come back to diabetes because
okay.
it's so important.
Well, then start there.
Let's start there because when I was a young pediatrician, I'd go to the children's diabetes clinic. I'd never see a child with type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes. It's now half the kids in that clinic.
Yeah.
And the life expectancy for a child with type 2 is worse than the old insulin-dependent kids because they have so many other problems going on at the same time. Average 14-year-old is about 14 pounds heavier. We've seen a doubling in diabetes in the U.S. just in the last 20 years. 2% of the entire GDP of the United States is now going to that one disease. So we're up at about 18% of all the money in the United States going to medical care, and 2% of that 18 is diabetes alone. So the costs of this are really enormous. And you had asked about why did people move out of the cities. One of the reasons people moved out of the cities is, you know, cities were, you know, people got sick there. They were dangerous. They were dirty. They weren't great places to live in 1910, 1920, the old cities downtown. And so people didn't want to be in that kind of ugly density any longer, so they did move out. But back then we were worried about infectious diseases, you know, tuberculosis, things that were caused by bad water. Now we're confronting chronic diseases, and these are the big cutters.
You know, television follows in large part what's going on in society, even in their drama and comedy shows. And I Love Lucy, back in the 50s, took place in an apartment building with Ethel Mertz and Fred, and they were in the middle of New York City. But at some point, they all moved to the suburbs because that's what was going on in American life. And you got the impression that they were moving out of this dark, cloistered, crowded, polluted environment to the clean, fresh air of the country, which leads us to asthma. And we'll come back and talk about that with Dr. Richard Jackson, who is the professor and chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Thanks for tuning into this encore edition of Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring iced tea for summer, freshly steeped and available all day, every day at area Bojangles. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, an update on Congress and the presidential campaigns. Congress only has 8 more days in session before senators and representatives take their August recess. The political party conventions begin in mid-July, so they'll have an update on what's happening in Congress and the presidential campaigns on the Diane Rehm Show, and that's in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, here on 90.7 WFAE. We'll have more of our encore edition of Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
We are covering the aftermath of a deadly attack last night at an international airport in Istanbul.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Dr. Cope says there are ways the Whitewater Center can make its water less conducive to the amoeba's growth.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is the former director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health, the highest-ranking public health official in the country, Dr. Richard Jackson. He is now the chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA and author of several books on the topic we're discussing today, which is how the built environment has led to an unhealthy America. He's also the host of a PBS series about this same topic. Asthma has been on the rise, and it is concurrent with this move out to the suburbs. People moved to the suburbs, at least in the early 50s and even in the 40s, to get away from the bad air of the cities. How can a move to the suburbs, where one would think that the air is cleaner, have led to a higher incidence of asthma?
Mike, I keep giving you the same answer to things, which is there are about five reasons for everything that happens in large populations. Number one, asthma has gone up, and it's doubled over the last 25 years or so, particularly asthma in children. There are environmental things, I think, that are causing this, and there are also probably behavior and dietary things. Obesity is a risk factor for asthma, number one. Number two, sealed buildings. And so over time, we've moved away from your house probably as a kid had steam heat, for example, or radiators. And we've moved to homes that have forced air. And forced air is a way of moving lots more allergens, things that cause stimulated allergens, around an environment. If you live in a house that has wall-to-wall carpeting, and a lot of that's the cheapest thing you can put on the floor of a house, that has 1,000 times the allergens per square foot that a bare floor has. So those changes in the environment are there. There's also some theory that probably has genuine substance to it, which is that if you make the environment too clean and people aren't being challenged with noxious things, and I'm not making this up, like parasites and other things, the allergic response, the so-called IgE, is set up to get rid of worms and parasites. And if it doesn't have work to do, it's probably looking for something else to go after. So it's called the hygiene hypothesis. We make things too clean, we're actually setting ourselves up for certain kinds of autoimmune responses. There's also a fair number of chemicals that isocyanates and others that will stimulate asthma, and I don't want to get into that technical stuff.
Although you've done a lot of work with the chemicals in the built environment over the years, and that is a major problem. But let's go back to wall-to-wall carpeting, because if wall-to-wall carpeting is a hotbed of activity for parasites and
– Well, not parasites, but at least dust and allergens.
Dust and allergens. And on the one hand, on the other hand, our immune systems don't have enough to work with, and so they're going after things that shouldn't harm us because they got to do something with their time. Why is having wall-to-wall carpet, which provides them something to fight against, a bad thing?
Well, but probably your GI tract or your intestines want to be fighting with it, not your lungs and the lining of your bronchioles. Right. So I think there's a lot of theories why it's going up, but it's certainly going up.
And so this move to the suburbs, this lack of exercise, this need to use a car, how we build the interiors of our home with the wall-to-wall carpeting and things like that, all lead to what we've been talking about here and ultimately lead to higher medical costs.
Oh, the medical costs are staggering. I'm not just saying it's only from how we've built America. It's how we eat. It's how we exercise. It's lots of causes we will collapse as a country if we continue it. When I was a young doc, 7% of all the money in the country went to medical care. Mm-hmm. It's now 18%.
Is that because we're sicker, or is that because things are simply more expensive? They're more fancy machines. They run more tests, some of which are necessary, some of which are not. What are the causes of that?
I keep giving you the same answer. Yes. the other big thing is, the equipment is very expensive, number one. And half that money spent in the last year of our lives. So we spend an awful lot of money at end-of-life care. And as a pediatrician, we feel pretty strongly we're not spending enough on the front-loading. One of the most important things you can do for a person's health is education. Hmm. And to not be putting money into education to prevention, immunization, those programs, and to be putting into end-of-life care, and I Everybody wants to have good care at the end of their lives, but good care doesn't mean always more technology.
Now, there's no real boogeyman, no scoundrel at the root cause of how we got to where we are and how the built environment has caused us to become less healthy as a country. You say that public health officials have little experience with urban planners, zoning boards, city councils, or others who make these built environment decisions. And few planners understand the health implications of design, land use, or transportation decisions. So we got these two groups of people who don't talk to each other and who don't understand. How do you bridge the gap?
One is this is Public Health Week, and 125 years ago, the Public Health Association was started, and half the people that started it were urban planners. And doctors were very involved, for example, in design and urban planning at the same time planners were involved, because we knew that where people live affected their health. There's been a big change over time, and I would say more and more health officials are actually reaching out to the planning agencies. So in my state, every county health department has a health person that goes to the planning meetings. Wait a minute, how's a child supposed to get to school? How does an elderly person who's isolated get to go about their lives? And thinking that Meals on Wheels and somebody picking you up is going to help you deal with your life, most old people in other cultures were able to live pretty well without having to have somebody come in a car and pick them up and take them wherever they needed to go. And as we look at the aging of the population, thinking about how we meet the needs for all these people. So there's going to have to be top-down leadership. Public officials have to say we need to build places that meet all ages, but we also have to do bottom-up leadership.
Are there places in the country that are working on this and doing things particularly well or particularly innovative where there is a track record of, hey, life is better now because we've done this?
Probably, and I obviously know California pretty well, but there's something called the Inland Empire, San Bernardino,
yes.
Riverside, and huge amounts of development. And a lot of it crashed. They were actually tearing down these homes in 2009, 2010. There have been a bunch of developments gone in, including relatively old industrial areas that are live-work-play, that have a transit center in town that people take a bus downtown. The kids can get to school by walking. They put accelerometers on the kids, and you can measure that they're walking. You can actually look at people's mental health, and the self-measurement is much better than it is in people in more isolated environments. Have we proved they live longer? No.
Okay. Now, I said a second ago that there probably isn't a boogeyman at the root of all this evil, that it's unintended consequences on a large number of people's.
There is one boogeyman.
Yes.
We go for too quick a return on investment, and we want to turn the money. We invest in the development, and we want the money back far too quickly. And if we actually captured many more of the costs, we probably would build more different.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
What I mean by that is if it is, for example, difficult to do brownfield investments, to build on vacant lots in cities.
Difficult because of the restrictions that you have to clean up the brownfield before you build on it?
And they're worried about the lawyers, and they're worried about liability, and the city binds them up with red tape.
But shouldn't they be worried?
When a city facilitates the use of in-town space to be used for people's needs, it really does work.
Well, what about the liability issues? If you're building on an old industrial site where the ground has been contaminated, do you really want to build on that site without making sure that it has in fact been cleaned up?
You can scrape off the soils. You can measure what's in there. You can get it down to acceptable levels. There are engineering fixes that you can put in place. For brownfields, they look at, let's not have more than a 1 in a million cancer risk for a lifetime of exposure. And every time one of the listeners drives 87 miles in the United States, they get a 1 in a million risk for death. So we worry about these chemical risks, which I'm not saying they're trivial, but we forget these much larger set of risks.
So is this another instance where urban planners and health officials need to talk?
Oh, yes.
Okay. You left – I was going to say that there may not be a boogeyman, but maybe there is, because you left the CDC after the Bush administration appointed new members to an advisory committee who had anti-regulatory backgrounds or ties to energy or chemical industries. Are you saying that the Bush administration deliberately sabotaged the positive or the protective work of the CDC while you were there, and that's why you left?
I had about a dozen advisory committees that answered to me around radiation, childhood lead poisoning. I was extremely unhappy one day. I came into work, and half the members of the childhood lead poisoning advisory committee were new names were handed to me, and about half of them came from the lead industry. And physician, the dean at Johns Hopkins was removed from the committee, and a proponent for the lead industry was put on the committee. And I admit I mouthed off about it.
Well, why wasn't that in the media? I mean, that seems to be a conflict of interest to me.
That was in the lead editorial in Science magazine.
Yeah, but nobody reads Science magazine except scientists.
Well,
why wasn't it on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the CBS Evening News or 60 Minutes?
I think in the United States, you know, you don't go out and do it in that way. You have to put it out in the science world.
But as the leading health official in the country at the time, did you not have an automatic platform to talk about this to the public, to the media, to be heard because of who you were at the time?
There were many situations where we were confronted with, do we continue to look at antibiotic resistance, and at the same time, I needed to maintain the budget for my agency. I had 1,000 people whose jobs depended on it, and you know, I was less worried about my job. I was a lot more worried about their jobs.
Was there a lot of this going on when you were at the CDC? Is there a lot of this going on today in government? Or do you know?
I would say it's less so. I'm probably the public health issue I worry about more than anything is climate change. And I know in some states, health leading officials are not allowed to talk about climate change. In Florida, people could get fired if they
talk about
climate change.
We can't talk about ocean rise in North Carolina.
You know, I think over the next – in this century, I'm not exaggerating. There are very serious people that think there may be 500 million deaths related to climate change. It doesn't take that much sea level rise to have all of Bangladesh be lost with sea level rise. That's 140 million people looking for a place to live.
But I don't think it'll get people's attention until people in Miami Beach are complaining because they have a 10th floor condominium which is now underwater.
It probably would only be the second floor.
Even so, they won't be able to get to their 10th floor condominium because of the second floor being underwater. All right. We have a lot of ground to cover before we end here. You say that if we're going to change the way we build our communities, it has to be done because of the demand of the citizenry. So what has to happen for citizens to recognize this problem and this opportunity to change?
You know, number one, America's very good at paying attention to what people spend money on. And, you know, if someone had said to you 10 years ago that a large portion of the food that people were buying or would opt for buying would be so-called organic food, and I'm talking about people with better income and good educational backgrounds. I was in Costco the other day, and there are big signs all across the meat racks and the cheese racks and everything else saying no antibiotics. That's a huge change. The public really is demanding much healthier food. Well, in a way, we've got to understand we need to demand much healthier neighborhoods and communities. And sitting in a car is not healthy. Being able to go about your life walking and biking and maybe public transportation is much healthier.
And those sprawling neighborhoods that we build and the fact that it's so difficult sometimes to build in cities on former brownfields or even do things in this – we had a big argument several years ago here about putting out sidewalk outdoor dining downtown because, you know, it just wasn't done. It's all done, it's all because of zoning laws which have helped automobiles and hurt – people is what you've been saying, but there's also other policies that have hurt people, like the Farm Bill. You're very critical of the Farm Bill.
You know, it's $14 billion a year in the Farm Bill, and at least in the past, and it supports corn, soy, and four other grain products, and it doesn't support fruits, vegetables, and the things that people need to eat. So healthy food is twice as expensive as it was in 1980 in real dollars, fruits and vegetables. and stuff that we don't need to eat so much of, grain, calories and oils, are half as expensive as they were then. So I actually would say the touchstone for the farm bill ought to be on people's health and what's good for people, and much less on, you know, maintaining huge amounts of production.
And a significant amount of America's fruits and vegetables come from California, where you are in an historic and life-threatening drought. So what will that do to the price of fruits and vegetables in the coming year?
Multiple thoughts. One is, you know, I left California yesterday. We had the first rain in the year 2015, and it was all of a half an inch. And I can't imagine that the production will be able to continue. There's no water in the Sierra. But U.S. produced lots of fruits and vegetables for everybody until we paved over our landscape near our cities. My home state of New Jersey was the Garden State,
right,
and produced huge amounts of wonderful food at least 5 to 6 months a year. So I think, you know, paving over our best farmland makes no sense.
What do you say to people who, whenever we talk about new urbanism, is when they say, I want the single family home in the suburbs with the driveway and the cul-de-sac and the white picket fence. What do you say? You say you don't have to lose those things.
No, you know, if you want that, you ought to have it. But a lot of our young people don't want that. They want to be in a lively place that they can meet their needs without having the car own them. And we don't give people enough choices right now that we're forcing people down the route of the white picket fence.
His new book, which has not been released yet, is going to talk about solutions to some of the problems that we have been talking about today. Dr. Richard J. Jackson, professor and chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks with